This is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer. And today I have the great pleasure of interviewing in this podcast Dr. Andrea Rosati, who is in the Department of Women and Child Health and Public Health in the Fondazione Policlinico Universitario Gemelli in Rome, Italy. Andrea is also a former fellow of the International Journal, so we're really happy to have him back. The topic for this discussion is his recent article titled Concurrent Endometrial Cancer in Atypical Endometrial Hyperplasia and the Role of Sentinel Lymph Nodes, Clinical Insights from a Multi-Center Experience. Andrea, great to see you. Welcome back. And thank you for accepting our invitation to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ramirez. It's always a pleasure and an honor for me participating in the activities of International Journal of Gynecological Cancer as a fellow, and also thank you so much for the invitation.
So Andrea, thank you again, of course, obviously, and such a pleasure to speak with you now as an author of a manuscript. So I wanted to, and we do have quite a number of questions because obviously a very interesting and important article. So I wanted to start, you know, obviously, among the concerns in patients with endometrial hyperplasia is the rate of concurrent endometrial cancer. However, most people would argue that the majority are going to be low grade with no or minimal invasion. So therefore, why should we really consider sentinel lymph node mapping in these patients?
Yes, great question. As you outlined, we also confirmed in our series that despite the high incidence of concurrent endometrial cancer that was 47.2%, the majority of identified cases fall within the low or intermediate risk category, which are the 71.4% as low risk and 9.7% as intermediate risk, according to ESGO ESRO-ESP guidelines. However, a significant proportion of 18.9% of concurrent endometrial cancer was classified as high intermediate or high risk, where the likelihood of lymph node metastasis we know is pretty high, ranging from 10 to 30%. But we have to stress that even in the low and intermediate risk group, lymph node metastases are not absent. And there are evidence supporting that in presumed low-risk patients with less than half myometrial invasion, G1-2 in endometrial cancer, there's still a lymph node metastasis rate nearly of 6%. For this reason, complete disease staging with assessment of nodal involvement remains a crucial prognostic and therapeutic factor, even in these low-risk groups. And in addition, sentinel lymph node is established and accepted as a part of surgical staging for other pre-neoplastic conditions, such as ductal carcinoma in situ of the breast, where the incidence of invasive tumor is approximately 50%, so superimposable to that of atypical hyperplasia. Considering these factors, we do believe that sentinel lymph node could be an option and should be carefully considered in this specific population, particularly because it becomes inaccessible after uterine removal, and so we lose some important information.
Excellent. So we wanted to start by also talking about the study design, and I was wondering if you can tell us about specifically what were some of your inclusion and exclusion criteria?
Yes, this was a retrospective study conducted between January 2010 and March 2022. We treated patients from three referral cancer centers in Italy: Policlinico Gemelli in Rome, Gemelli Molise in Campobasso, and University of Parma. Inclusion criteria were preoperative histological diagnosis of atypical endometrial hyperplasia, and there must be a radical surgical treatment, meaning hysterectomy plus or minus sentinel lymph node, while exclusion criteria were patients with preoperative diagnosis of endometrial hyperplasia without atypia or those with endometrial cancer at the beginning. We also excluded patients who underwent conservative treatment. We divided the population in group one, which included patients treated with hysterectomy, simple hysterectomy plus or minus salpingo oophorectomy, in group two, hysterectomy plus sentinel lymph node. And we evaluated the overall rate of concurrent endometrial cancer as primary endpoint. And we assessed also the prevalence of different risk classes according to ESGO-ESTRO ESP classification and compare the surgical outcomes and pathological variables between the two study groups.
Excellent. So now let's talk about the highlights of the study. What are the results that you really want to obviously share with our audience as the key points in the study?
Okay. We enrolled 460 patients with a typical endometrial hyperplasia, 192 within group 1 and 268 within group 2. No difference were found in baseline characteristics, so while a significant difference was found in terms of ultrasound features and ultrasound diagnosis, indicative for endometrial polyp was more represented in group 1, while inhomogeneous endometrial thickening was more represented in group 2. Concerning primary endpoint, 47.2% of patients were upgraded to endometrial cancer at final pathological examination. Among these cancer cases, 97.7% exhibited an endometrioid histotype, while 92.2% falling in G1-2 category. And according to risk classification, as expected, 71.4% is represented by low risk, 9.7% by intermediate risk, 11.1% by high intermediate group, and 7.8% by high risk tumors. Therefore, as already mentioned, 18.9% of patients displayed a high intermediate to high risk features with high risk of lymph node spread. The overall sentinel lymph node detection rate was 95% with bilateral mapping of 84%. And positive lymph nodes were found in 12 patients, accounting for 7.6% of the population. Of these 12 patients, 9 had micrometastasis, 2 had macrometastasis, and 1 isolated tumor cells. Finally, concerning surgical outcomes, we found no difference in terms of estimated blood loss, operative time, and intra and postoperative complication between the two groups. So we can conclude that sentinel lymph node biopsy added prognostic and therapeutic information in all cancer cases. Obviously, it's important to highlight that 7.6% of patients had a positive lymph node status, but also in negative lymph node status, especially in the 12.3% of high intermediate risk patients, the decision was important because we made a decision about brachytherapy versus external beam radiotherapy in this specific group according to the presence or absence of lymph node staging. We also confirmed that sentinel lymph node is a safe procedure, and that's why the rate of patients undergoing sentinel lymph node biopsy doubled every 2 years along the study period, reaching 79.1% during the last 2 years, according to our technical skills.
So really lots of interesting data, and I'd like to get to some of the questions, obviously, that we have put together for you. And the first one is, how was the preoperative diagnosis of atypical hyperplasia determined? In other words, how many patients were diagnosed with just a simple office pipel, and how many patients actually had like a targeted biopsy under anesthesia, in other words, a curettage? A more extensive evaluation, I would say.
Yes, it's a very interesting question. The PIPEL method is not widely utilized in Italy, and all patients received an hysteroscopy when initially treated at the three center of the study. Only in a small fraction of cases, the diagnosis was potentially made after dilation and curettage when patients were referred from other centers, secondary center. Due to the retrospective nature of the study, the information on how the diagnosis was obtained in each patient initially was not available, so we are not able to specifically address this issue. However, in our institution, we systematically apply a target hysteroscopic biopsy And we also recommend a centralized pathological diagnosis in order to minimize interpretation bias.
So, Andrea, would you then, knowing obviously what you have learned so far from this study, would it be reasonable to refer patients diagnosed by a PIPEL, as you know, commonly used here in the United States to diagnose endometrial cancer, for an actual targeted biopsy before actually doing sentinel lymph nodes? In other words, not just doing sentinel lymph nodes on every patient with hyperplasia, but rather perhaps those patients that had the biopsy by PIPEL getting a curettage targeted biopsy and then making the decision about sentinel lymph node mapping.
Yes, absolutely. We do agree that repeating a targeted biopsy could be useful by different perspectives. We can target the most suspicious area or areas and perform a specific biopsy on them. And we would have a more accurate description of endometrial thickening and of the hysteroscopic scenario. A polyp is different from endometrial thickening, and even the location within the uterine cavity could be important. Just from a speculative perspective, lesion could be localized in the fundus of the uterus at the level of the tubal ostium, in the corpus, or a widespread diffusion throughout the cavity. So this could modify or direct the intraoperative suspicion, for example, regarding lymph node spread according to different uterine lymphatic drainages, which are the paraortic at the level of the fundus and pelvic for the corpus. With this regard, we recently published a study showing a statistically significant association between hysteroscopic spread throughout the whole cavity and the sentinel lymph node uptake in the common iliac lymph node, suggesting that there may be a role of the location of the lesion that would have not yet fully understood. Finally, all the specimen would be analyzed by expert gynecologists, and this would be relevant considering the poor reproducibility of the diagnosis of atypical hyperplasia.
So this next question comes to us from Yossi Sewer. He's one of our fellows now in the journal, and he's from Montreal. And he's wondering about the centers that are actually performing this. And his question is, were the proportions of group one to group two similar across all three participating centers? And if not, was there a sub-analysis conducted to evaluate each center separately? Would the results be consistent?
Oh, this is an interesting question. We did not include the specific sub-analysis in the article. However, when looking at the three centers, we noticed that a higher proportion of patients undergoing sentinel lymph node biopsy was clustered in Rome when compared to the other two centers, 81% more or less in Rome versus 33% in the other two centers. However, when we look at the primary endpoint of the study, that was the rate of concurrent endometrial cancer, this was almost homogeneous among the three centers, 43% in Parma, 50% in Campobasso, and 49% in Rome.
This next question comes to us from Beatriz Navarro from the Canary Islands, and I think it goes back to, again, the screening of these patients. And she says, how would you explain that there were more patients with endometrial cancer in the sentinel lymph node group, 61%, than in the non-sentinel lymph node group, 21%, or 28%, I should say. So perhaps because preoperatively it was thought that some patients were more likely to have endometrial cancer by looking, as an example, with an ultrasound. Therefore, it was decided to perform sentinel lymph nodes in these patients. In other words, if you use all these other techniques, like an ultrasound, perhaps an MRI, would one be able to triage patients better to determine who uses sentinel lymph nodes and who doesn't?
Yes. As you accurately highlighted, there's a great incidence of patients exhibiting heterogeneous endometrial thickening within the cohort designated for sentinel lymph node, suggesting maybe an allocation bias given the retrospective nature of the study. Indeed, we show that preoperative predictors of concurrent endometrial cancer included in our series were ultrasound finding of inhomogeneous endometrial thickening and endometrial thickness more than 20 millimeters. However, in this study, we did not use standardized preoperative suspicion guided criteria to perform sentinel lymph node biopsy or not. And the decision was performed, was influenced by the confidence gained with the technique over time, especially in the last 2 years over the study period, when the rate of sentinel lymph node doubled, reaching 79%.
Now, you mentioned that of the patients who had cancer, 92% had grade 1 or grade 2. These patients traditionally would not need a lymph node assessment by the old sort of like the Mariani criteria. Do you have any information on the death of invasion in these patients, in that 92% of patients with grade 1 or grade 2?
That's a great question. Of the 200 cases of G1 and 2 endometrial cancer, accounting for the 92.2% of the cancer population, we had a 17.5% with myometrial invasion more than 50% and 82.5% of myometrial invasion less than 50%. However, it's interesting to note that in patients with G1 and 2 tumor who underwent sentinel lymph node biopsy, 6 patients reported sentinel lymph node metastasis, accounting for the 4% in the G1 and 2 population, usually considered at no risk of lymph node metastasis. So as we said before, and we would like to stress this concept, there is no population or subgroup with a zero rate of lymph node metastasis.
Now, you mentioned that high to intermediate risk constituted 12.3% of the group. What made them high to intermediate risk?
We classified all endometrial cancer cases according to the ESGO-ESRS guidelines published in November 2020. So we categorized this group as 1BG3, stage 2, or lymphovascular substantial involvement. We wanted to stress this specific population in the discussion because in this patient, adjuvant therapy is tailored by lymph node staging. In patients with sentinel lymph node negative, vaginal brachytherapy alone is accepted, while for patients without lymph node assessment, is suggested external beam radiotherapy. So in this specific population, performing sentinel lymph node had a direct impact on adjuvant treatment, avoiding an escalation therapy in case of negative lymph node.
Now, regarding the lymph node metastases, you noted that macrometastases corresponded to only 1.2% of patients diagnosed with cancer. And the question is, is it justified performing lymph node assessment on all patients with suspected atypical endometrial hyperplasia, knowing that likely you're only going to treat this very small percentage of patients?
Yes. To date, it is currently accepted and included in international guidelines that presence of micrometastasis is associated with worse prognosis, and the presence of both macro and micrometastasis less than 2 millimeters is regarded as metastatic lymph node involvement. So additionally, the strength of sentinel lymph node biopsy is not only in the reduced morbidity, but also in the chance to perform ultrastaging and detect these small volume metastasis. So regarding our series, I would say that sentinel lymph node allowed us to identify and treat 11 patients with metastatic lymph node, accounting for the 6.7% of endometrial cancer population. And these patients were considered, thanks to sentinel lymph node, and clustered in the high-risk category and treated with sequential external beam radiotherapy plus chemotherapy or concomitant chemoradiation plus chemotherapy according to PORTEC-3 trial. Furthermore, the ultra-staging technique opened an unsolved issue that is currently for the management of the isolated tumor cells, In fact, a recently published study by Cucinella and colleagues showed that patients with sentinel lymph node isolated tumor cell and low risk profile without adjuvant chemotherapy had a significantly worse recurrence-free survival compared with node-negative patients. With this regard, we found one case of ETC. We did not consider this as a metastatic involvement, but obviously there is still room for other insights in this specific subset of patients.
These next two questions come to us from Ilaria Capasso from Italy. You may know her. And her first question is, based on your study, would you still consider avoiding site-specific lymphadenectomy in the event of not detecting sentinel lymph nodes in patients with atypical hyperplasia? And if so, what if a patient has a preoperative thickened endometrium, as an example, greater than 20 millimeters assessed by ultrasound, or an ARID1A mutation?
Yes. Currently, our internal policy regarding atypical hyperplasia involves avoiding site-specific lymphadenectomy in our surgical algorithm, irrespective of preoperative factors such as endometrial thickness. This decision stems from the absence of specific and validated preoperative variables that reliably stratify the risk of concurrent endometrial cancer. However, at present, our efforts are precisely focused on addressing this issue. Furthermore, it is important to know that the reported bilateral detection rate of 84% is to date at our institution progressively improving. This improvement can be attributed to the refinement of the technique and the implementation of specific technical measures. And over the last 3 years, we have reported a consistent increase in bilateral mapping. From 2021 to 2023, the rate rose from 81 to 90%. Our technique has been standardized according, obviously, to recently published consensus on surgical technique for sentinel lymph node. And we are also prospectively applying AI methods in terms of computer vision algorithm to maximize sentinel lymph node detection rate. With regard to molecular analysis, although the finding concerning the loss of ARID1A are interesting and for sure could be beneficial, as its loss was related to a very high rate of concurrent endometrial cancer at final pathology, 93%, it is not currently implemented in our clinical practice due to logistic reasons.
So you did mention actually a little bit about AI, artificial intelligence. And actually, Ilaria's second question was pertaining to, do you think that artificial intelligence applied to ultrasound or potentially digital pathology will be much more integrated in this algorithm in the future?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Integrating artificial intelligence with standard transvaginal ultrasound may enhance the accuracy in the detection of endometrial cancer, concurrent endometrial cancer. And because AI can analyze some specific image features, including shape, pixel intensity, or other features that cannot be discernible by the sonographer's eye. So this integration has the potential to decrease the number of misdiagnoses, but as another important potential that also is to reduce the inter-institutional variability in sonographers' expertise.
So now I have another question that submitted to us. And the question is, given that a large number of patients had tumors greater than 2 centimeters, invasion greater than 50%, and cervical invasion actually in 12 patients, do the authors not consider that perhaps these patients could have been better stratified if perhaps an MRI had been performed?
Yes, that's an excellent observation, because achieving accurate preoperative radiological assessment is of paramount importance, obviously. And however, it's essential to acknowledge that challenges posed by the limited accessibility and time-consuming nature of MRI. While some researchers indicate that transvaginal ultrasound and MRI perform equally when preparative staging of endometrial cancer in the hands of experienced sonographer, other studies suggest that MRI may offer advantages in certain aspects, specific aspects of the diagnosis. MRI tends to be more accurate in detecting deep myometrial invasion and cervical stromal infiltration. So overall, transvaginal ultrasound remains a valuable initial imaging technique due to its accessibility and the cost effectiveness, especially in experienced hands. And in case where results are inconclusive, maybe MRI could be recommended for further evaluation.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think, you know, certainly to suggest an MRI for basically every patient with endometrial hyperplasia is absolutely not cost effective. But as you mentioned, ultrasound may be a very useful tool. So since we're on the topic of cost effectiveness, of course, how do you balance the potential higher cost and potential higher likelihood of complications, although in your case, you did not show that, of sentinel lymph node mapping in all patients with atypical hyperplasia?
Yes, as reported in literature, sentinel lymph node mapping is the most cost-effective strategy to guide a need for adjuvant therapy, and in patients with low to intermediate risk endometrial cancer, is associated with almost $1,000 decrease in compared with lymph node dissection. Certainly, this finding pertain to endometrial cancer cases, so it's important to be cautious when extrapolating them for atypical hyperplasia, considering that only approximately half of the population ultimately receive endometrial cancer diagnosis. However, sentinel lymph node could be theoretically cost-effective even in this setting for at least two reasons. One is because it reduces the disease relapse resulting from inadequate initial treatment, so the cost associated to disease relapse. And secondly, because it offers the possibility for a more tailored therapeutic approach and could further decrease overall costs by avoiding the need for escalated therapy. In terms of cost for the operative room, we found that sentinel lymph node did not prolong operative time, and we observed no intra or postoperative complication specifically associated to that that may have an impact on costs.
So this question comes from Sabrina Piedimonti and also in Montreal, and she's interested about impact on survival. And her question is, do you have any data on survival? Because it would be interesting to see how many of the patients with hyperplasia recurred, or if there was any difference in survival with sentinel lymph node dissection versus certainly not doing so. What are your thoughts as it pertains to survival in the patients who ultimately end up having cancer?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, we lack this information as the predominance of low-risk tumor has not resulted in a sufficient number of events to establish median disease-free survival or median overall survival in the two groups. However, this will represent a crucial and important area for our future investigation, and we hope to answer this question.
So now I just have a couple more questions, Andrea. What do you see as the weaknesses of the study?
Obviously, there are some selection bias, as already mentioned, due to the retrospective nature of the study within the two groups. There are some imbalances, especially in the ultrasound, the preoperative ultrasound features. Another limitation is the extended enrollment period, which resulted in a non-standardized preoperative diagnostic workup and in an incomplete comprehensive molecular profiling of all cancer cases. Finally, a centralized pathological review by a gynecologic pathologist, an expert gynecologic pathologist, was not routinely performed. And I think that these are the main concerns and limitation of our study.
So, as a last question, Andrea, I wanted to ask you, I often ask this to the authors of many of these manuscripts. Our audience will clearly, obviously, also want to know what is routinely done today at Gemelli in patients with endometrial hyperplasia. Are you routinely doing sentinel lymph node mapping on these patients?
So, today, considering the insights provided by the article, our algorithm consistently involves preoperative approach combining expert ultrasound and hysteroscopy. So, patients diagnosed with atypical hyperplasia undergo immunohistochemical characterization, MMR and P53, but not molecular profiling. Through this approach, we observed a significant implication for treatment of our patient, especially in the MMRD group. We were able to identify three cases of Lynch syndrome in patients with atypical hyperplasia. Building upon this retrospective series, we obviously aim to devise an internal algorithm in order to tailor the approach of sentinel lymph node based on concurrent endometrial cancer risk. So, this algorithm will incorporate the available information at our center in the precise moment, including ultrasound findings, as we have confirmed in homogeneous endometrial thickening and endometrial thickness more than 20 millimeters are predictive factors for concurrent endometrial cancer. Hysteroscopic observation, distinguishing diffuse thickening from focal thickening, single polyp, and also the location of the disease. Immunohistochemical markers, MMR and P53 status. Pathological features, specifically referring to focal versus diffuse atypical hyperplasia. So this is our algorithm at the moment. And as a future direction, we aim to implement this algorithm in every section by integrating artificial intelligence, as said, for the ultrasound, computer vision for the hysteroscopy, and digital pathology.
Outstanding. Well, Andrea, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure speaking with you. Really, truly, congratulations to you and your team for looking into this important question. And of course, obviously, adding this important information to the literature. Thank you once again for accepting our invitation.
Thank you so much, Pedro. It's a pleasure and honor being here with you, and looking forward to work on this topic to give more insights in this topic. Thank you so much.
Excellent.